If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
When Sweet Tarts dared to combine sweet and tart, they thought, why stop there? Why not create other exciting and unexpected combinations, like rainbows and ropes, or fruity and gummy, or chewy and more chewy? That's why they created fun treats like Sweet Tarts Twisted Rainbow Ropes, Gummies Fruity Splits, and Chewy Fusions. When you dare to combine, it's sure to blow your mind. Sweet Tarts, dare to combine. Visit SweetTartsCandy.com to shop now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. After sitting next to the poet and painter William Blake at a dinner party one evening, Henry Crabb Robinson wondered in his diary whether Blake was, quote, artist or genius or mystic or madman. Well, today I'll be trying to untangle those contradictions with John Higgs, who's the author of William Blake versus the World, a new biography that reveals how an eccentric man now hailed in the pantheon of British art was ignored and mocked during his lifetime, and how Blake's work is still misunderstood today. Thanks very much for joining me, John. So your new book is all about William Blake. I think if you say to most listeners in the UK, William Blake, they'll know the words to the hymn Jerusalem. We've got green and pleasant land, dark satanic mills, which come from a Blake poem. They might also know Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright. And maybe some people will know that Blake was also a painter as well as a poet. But what do we really need to remember about him other than that?
Well, I think he was unique, basically. I don't think we've ever had anyone quite like him to be so talented on so many levels. You know, we don't have national poets who are also regarded as brilliant, brilliant artists who have their own, you know, massive retrospectives at Tate Britain. And we don't understand him. That's the interesting thing. He saw the world in a way that is so different to how we see it, that there's something about his work that is incredibly attractive and appealing, and we all feel drawn to it, yet we're slightly scared of at the same time. A lot of people think, oh yeah, I like Blake, I love Blake, but they don't read him. They don't sort of go into him. We're a little bit sort of wary of him, which is a real shame, because when you go into him, I think he's just the sort of figure that, you know, we sort of need at the moment. There's obviously it's a sort of very divided time, and Blake has this weird ability to sort of bring people from all corners of our society together. He's, you know, the Conservative Party will sing Jerusalem. You'll hear it at the last night at the proms. You'll hear it played by The Fall. You'll hear it at the Women's Institute. You'll hear it by the English cricket team. You know, he unites the left and the right. He unites the establishment and the avant-garde. And also, weirdly, he unites atheists and those who are religious and spiritually inclined. There's just no one in our history, in our culture, who has this ability to draw us all together like this.
speaking about that popularity there that you mentioned, obviously there was a massive William Blake exhibition in 2019 at the Tate, and it was hugely successful. There's something about Blake's work, as you say, that clearly speaks to us today. But what do you think that is?
It's he had a way of seeing the world which we recognise as different to ours, and it has different values behind it. And we kind of feel that we've lost something, that we're missing something, and that maybe he had the clue. There's a quote from Jerusalem on a new grave marker that's on his grave in Bunhill Fields. And it says, "I give you the end of a piece of string, only wind it into a ball. It will lead you into heaven's gate, built in Jerusalem's wall." He's like offering us. He's offering us a sort of a line into a sort of a more numinous place.
So you start the book with the reflections of a guy called Henry Crabb Robinson, who met Blake, and he wrote in his diary that he wasn't sure if Blake was artist or genius or mystic or madman, which, I mean, is very intriguing, isn't it? Is that what you're trying to get to the bottom of in this biography?
Yeah, I think so. I think I'm trying to understand his mind more so than the straight biography, or more than a straight analysis of his poetry or his paintings. I'm trying to understand how he saw the world. We're in a much better position to do that now. We have a far greater understanding of how the mind works than we did, 200 years ago. And so when he talks of his visions, we understand that he was certainly he was not neurotypical, I think is the phrase that is used. But we sort of have ways in now to sort of understand what he was experiencing and what he was sort of seeing. I mean, I called the book William Blake versus the World, because most of the way his story is told is very much the world versus William Blake. You know, he was ignored, he was mocked, he was seen as a madman, he died penniless in a pauper's grave. He was this sort of forgotten figure, and on a sort of material level, on the worlds of wealth and finance and success, he was utterly defeated by the world. But he was working on a completely different territory to that. The story of William Blake versus the world is a very different story to the world versus William Blake, I think.
So you mentioned there the fact that Blake had this completely left of field worldview, really. And I think that is really important to understand if you're going to look at any of his paintings or read any of his poems, because it really informed the work that he made, didn't it? So what can you tell us about Blake's belief system, as it were?
Well, there's so many different aspects to it. There's the political, there's the sexual, there's the spiritual, there's the religious. There's all these different sort of ways in, and you have to sort of grasp each of them to sort of see how they all sort of cohere as a whole.
So Blake saw himself as a Christian, but his views were not necessarily in alignment with most churchgoers at the time, I think it's fair to say. So how would you describe this kind of religious aspect of his worldview, and maybe how that fed into politics as well?
Yes, you're right. He absolutely saw himself as a Christian. He was not a person who went to church in any way. He wasn't a person who sort of believed the doctrines of the church, but he believed in Christ, essentially, in this inner light of Christ. Except what he was talking about really was the imagination. He saw the human imagination as this divine force that sort of flooded into this sort of finite, closed, limited, material sort of world. And that was our saviour. He would talk about, people who aren't painters or artists or architects, they're not Christian. Christ and his disciples were all artists, as he saw it. It was the act of creating, of bringing something new into the world. That was really what religion was about for him. So he's very critical of priests and priestcrafts. He talks of priests in black gowns with doing their rounds and binding in brass my joys and desires. He sees them very much as crushing the human spirit. He refers to God as Nobo Daddy, which is a really sort of current sounding sort of neologism, Nobo Daddy. There's a lot more secular 21st century people will agree with in what he says. He saw all gods and angels and demons and things as being within us. Everything was within us. It wasn't God outside. We created them all ourselves. All deities reside in the human breast, as he said, which really changes how you see religion in a very sort of profound way. I mean, we might not say believe in hell these days. We don't believe that hell is a real place that exists and it's out there in some strange realm that we might be sent to. Very few people actually believe that. But for Blake, hell was an internal state. We create our own hell inside us when we cut ourselves off from people and hide our light. And even though we might not believe in hell, we've probably met someone who is living in hell. And if you accept that you know someone who may be living in hell, then that opens the idea that the people who are living in paradise. All this was 100 years before Freud and Jung and our current understanding of psychology. So that's really how you should understand and sort of look at his work and a real examination of what goes on inside us.
It's some huge ideas that Blake is grappling with here. Do you see it as something that is coherent? Is it a coherent set of beliefs when you put it all together, or is it a hodgepodge of different aspects?
It's surprisingly coherent, I think. No one's making any claim that anyone understands it all, and it all fits together perfectly, and there's no contradictions. He's much more playful than the sort of thinker who comes up with a rigid, fixed system of how to understand the world. He's very much exploring how different part of ourselves, different energies within ourselves, clash and the dynamics between, countries, which is a big, important idea in his thought. And yet, surprisingly, it does fit together quite well. It does come to, once you've found a few keys to unlock what he's talking about, there is a worldview there that I think is still valuable and useful here in the 21st century.
So at the time that Blake was writing, how dangerous was it to be throwing ideas out there around religion and, say, priests corrupting people?
It was a very, very paranoid time. And it was certainly politically very dangerous. There's a story that he knew Tom Paine well enough to warn him to leave the country before he was arrested. Obviously, the French Revolution had huge repercussions around how governments and things perceived the people below them. And the British establishment was extremely scared and paranoid that there was going to be an uprising here. And so you get examples like when Blake was living in Felpham in the early 1800s, and he found a soldier, a guy called Jack Schofield, in his garden. And he got into an argument with him, and he sort of marched him down the street and sort of forced him back to where he was billeted. And the soldier claimed that Blake had been saying, "Damn the king and damn all his soldiers." This was sedition. He could have been hanged for this. And there was a huge trial that really weighed on him over many years and really was very damning for his mental health in many ways. It was a risky, strange time.
It's strange, isn't it, that with all the kind of radical, revolutionary work that Blake was making, the stuff that he actually got in trouble for was an argument on the street.
In many ways, he just wasn't famous enough to get into trouble. He was ignored so much during his life and looked down upon a bit. He went to the Royal Academy, and some of his friends and his peers went on to do great things, and he didn't. And he was very much sort of seen as difficult or mad or strange, or people kind of left him alone a little bit.
So his kind of lack of success in life, do you think that was more due to the fact that he was a difficult personality to engage with rather than the fact that people didn't really understand or appreciate his work?
I think it was mainly that they didn't understand his work. It was such a different way of thinking to what they were used to. And that's what gradually made him more of a difficult and harder person to sort of work with. At the core of his philosophy, there is a disagreement with one of the most central ideas in Western thought, which comes from, well, before Plato, really, the idea that the mind and matter are two separate things. It was sort of picked up by Christianity, and it's at the core of the great universities of the time, Oxford and Cambridge. And for those people who had gone through that form of education, it was almost impossible to understand what he was talking about because he differed on such a fundamental level that they were blind to it. They couldn't see it. They couldn't quite understand him at all. He didn't help himself. He didn't really try to explain himself very well. He often launched into works and poems and things, assuming that as long as he knew what he was talking about, then everyone else should be able to follow. You know, he was not a reader-friendly writer in many ways. Which is a real shame because he had some great points to make.
You mentioned earlier about the fact that Blake had visions, and I just want to dig into that a little bit more. So how did he experience these visions, or how did he describe his experience of these visions? Were they something threatening to him, or were they pretty, you know, banal? And how did they influence his work as well?
They were wonderful for him. They're a real joy. He felt blessed and honoured to have them. One of the first was about 8 years old when he walked down to Peckham Rye, and which is all, you know, wild open fields and everything at that time. And he was sitting down, he looked up at this tree. On every branch was an angel. This tree was spangled with angels. And it was just such a glorious sight. And, you know, he went home and he told his parents, and they didn't believe him. They thought he was lying. His father was going to beat him. And that's when he realised that, you know, other people didn't see the world how he did. But he never thought the way he saw the world was wrong. He thought, you know, it was a skill that you could develop, and to do so was better than not doing it. And people who didn't see the world and didn't see angels and spiritual figures were missing out. He had something that other people didn't. And his wife utterly believed him. There's a really interesting field of research at the moment about what's called hyperphantasia and aphantasia. These are the study of the mind's eye, what we see when we close our eyes and we imagine something. If you were to close your eyes and say imagine a cow, what happened in your head would be very different between different people. Most people would sort of see something vaguely cow-like or something like that. A lot of people see absolutely nothing at all. They have a condition called aphantasia, which is you have no mind's eye at all. And a lot of people that say Pixar are aphantasic. It's really interesting where it's sort of linked to sort of visual artistry. So they can't see something in their head. They have to physically create it on a computer or on canvas or something like that. But at the opposite end of the scale, there's hyperphantasia. Now, it seems to be even rarer, but it's like if you were to ask someone with hyperphantasia to close their eyes and imagine a cow, there would be a cow there. They would smell the cow, they would feel the heat from its breath, the smell of its hide. It would be so, so vivid. There'd be very little difference between eyes open and eyes closed. And it seems very likely that Blake was hyperphantasic. He always talked about how he always saw in vision everything he painted, everything he was in front of his mind's eye. You have examples where he was drawing this horrible figure called the ghost of a flea.
Oh, yeah, which is incredibly haunting.
It's incredibly creepy. And there's a sketch he was doing for someone, and he was seeing the ghost of a flea in his mind's eye, but the flea moved. And so he had to stop and had to redraw the face differently because it had moved that way. It wasn't that, you know, he was just imagining this face. He was seeing what he sort of visually saw. And people who are hyperphantasic, they it affects me in really interesting ways. They daydream a lot more, but they also tend to have a lot of social conscience. In the book, I talked to an artist called Claire Dewdney, and she's hyperphantasic. And, you know, she talks about how she was reading a book on a train when someone got a nail in their foot on the story. And because they're hyperphantasic, this was so visual to them and visceral that they almost passed out. She just couldn't sort of handle it. And when you see Blake's mind working in these ways, you understand why a lot about his politics, about how furious he was about, say, child chimney sweeps, which was, you know, one of the big issues at the time. Because most people can talk about child chimney sweeps fairly sort of calmly and rationally. But if you see in your mind's eye these small children in these you know, these horrible conditions, there's this sort of the choking coal dust, the cramped, confined conditions that they're sort of put into, of course you're going to be angry. Of course you're going to be furious. Of course you're going to say it's sort of not acceptable. So there is a sort of a clear correlation, I think, between the sort of hyper-visual imagination of the way his mind worked and the strength and sort of anger behind his politics.
You mentioned there about the idea in Hyperphantasia that you could have smell and sight and sound all intermingled. And I don't know whether there's any parallel between that and the way that Blake kind of approached his art, in that he obviously was a poet, but he was also a visual artist. Did he see a division between those two fields, or did he see them all as part of the same thing?
Yeah, this is really interesting. He saw them all as part of the same thing. In a way, we're sort of vaguely familiar with now in the world of multimedia, or, you know, graphic novels where there's a story and there's pictures at the same time. But it was so unusual and rare at the time for him to conceive of a creative work that is visual, that is an illustration, that is a poem, that is a song at the same time, which he had music, which unfortunately has been lost to us for some things. He saw all these different aspects of creative expression as part of the same visual sort of thing. And there was just no one like it. And there still isn't, really. There still isn't.
He was quite open about the fact that he had these visions and that they informed this worldview that was behind his art. How did people respond to that at the time?
Not well, generally. Not well. I mean, his friends certainly loved him, but he was very easy to dismiss for artists and art critics. And there was a sort of a class of gentlemen who had a stranglehold on the arts, probably putting it a bit strong. But it was not a world that anyone could sort of break into. And you see this in the one review he got. He held an exhibition in 1809, I think it was, above his brother's shop. And there was one review by a guy, I think, called Lee Hunt. And it's so patronizing and it's so damning. And he refers to Blake as an unfortunate lunatic who's only prevented from being incarcerated by his personal inoffensiveness. You know, he's just beneath them. And here's the idea that Blake saw himself as such a great artist, which he did, and he was very loud about. He was just, you know, dismissed and mocked.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
In the 18th century, English artists did not come up with images like that. It's so from nowhere, you know. It's just a beautiful piece of design, but the atmosphere to it is wonderful. It's really wonderful.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud. Or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Something that you talk about in the book, which I found really interesting, was this idea that after Blake's death, critics wanted to kind of diminish or downplay the fact that of his, quote, madness, because that would in some way kind of undermine the power and the importance of his work.
Yes, I think so. So I'm particularly sort of academics and scholars in the 20th century have often sort of tried to play this down or to dismiss the idea that he was mad, because when you look at his work, it's very easy to go, well, he was mad, so I'm really wasting my time sort of looking at this. There's a desire to go, no, look closer, to read it closer, understand it. It contrasts with the legacy of Vincent van Gogh, for example, who everyone accepts that he had mental health problems, and they sort of add to his story. They're all part of the bigger picture of his work. It's quite clear that particularly in the early 1800s, his mental health was not in a good way, and there was a very sort of paranoid aspect to a lot of the things he said. And he would start feuds and fights with different artists, which were very one-sided. He would be attacking someone for reasons that the person didn't never really kind of understood, and don't seem to make much sense when we go back and look at the letters at the time and things like that. It does seem that he was in a bad way in many ways at this point.
So just on a personal level, with Blake, there's a lot to kind of grapple with here as a biographer, because you say he had a lot of friends and he was quite personally inoffensive, but then on the other hand, we have this paranoia and this ability to start fights. So, you know, if we turned up to a dinner party and we sat next to William Blake, what kind of man would we encounter?
A lot would depend at what time in his life this was. I mean, I start the book with him at a dinner party towards the end of his life, when everyone just sort of falls for him. He's just lovely. He's childlike, and he's sort of kind and such a sparkle to his eyes, and he says beautiful things, and he seems to see the world in a way that's left him at peace. And it's very, very appealing. When he was a young man, he would attend, not very often, he would attend the occasional sort of artist circle sort of gathering. And people would go to these events. Joseph Johnson, the radical publisher who he worked for, would hold these meals with very simple food, but it would be Tom Paine, it would be Mary Wollstonecraft, it would be all these wonderful, interesting people. And the debate would be stimulating. And a lot of what was talked about there has sort of fed into the Age of Enlightenment and how we sort of see the world. Blake didn't go to sort of learn how to see the world. He already knew how to see the world. He had no interest in trying to understand how things should be. He knew them. So he was stubborn and prickly in certain ways. And then certainly in sort of middle age, when the sort of the paranoia sort of crept in, he seemed to be much more of a lonely figure at that sort of point. His wife Catherine was always there for him, so he always had this sort of this home, this loving core of his life that he could go back to. If he hadn't had that, you know, it would, God knows where it would have gone. And as we move into sort of the 1820s, he sort of worked through a lot of his problems. I think by doing his sort of great masterwork, Jerusalem, which was such an analysis of the workings of his own sort of mind, it feels like prototherapy in some ways to me, so that he sort of came out in a positive way. He could so easily have come out sort of a nihilistic, sort of pessimistic, bitter. He could easily have come out bitter, and he didn't. You know, he came out singing and full of joy at the end of his life.
You mentioned that Blake's work can be quite unnerving, and I would terms of some of it kind of creepy and quite eerie and dark. What do you think was behind that? What was playing into it?
Well, it's very gothic. There's always a sense of, you know, the great weight of the past pressing down on the present moment. It's not illustrations of our world. It's illustrations of the internal states of him. And there's a sense of melodrama about it. And his language is all very sort of rich and hysterical is probably pushing it a bit too far, but he's certainly manic. If you can imagine, if it was modern day, there'd be a lot of caps and an exclamation mark.
It's very high stakes, isn't it?
It's very, very high stakes. But it was the state of his soul was at stake. You know, that it should be high stakes. You know, we have this brief period on Earth, and our our mind or our soul, if you prefer, you know, can be wretched or it can be just blissful. You know, it matters, these things, as much as we might like to dismiss them.
And in this kind of master worldview that he created in his work, there were some recurring characters, I guess you could say. What could you tell us about some of those?
Yeah, he basically created his own mythology from about the 1790s onwards. In his early work, he'd refer to Greek mythology or biblical. Well, he always loved biblical stories. He always go back to biblical stories. But while most artists kept to those sort of, you know, set worlds, he created an entirely new one with characters like Urizen and Orc and Los that he never really introduced. He never really explained who they were. It's just when you look at his entire body of work together and sort of see how they all fit and work out, you realize that he's basically divided his own mind or everyone's mind into four different aspects to see how they interact and then see the dynamics between them. So Urizen, his most significant, important character, he's essentially our left brain. He's rational. He frames the outside world as this sort of small finite model and utterly believes in it and believes he's God of that sort of world. He's that sort of cold, rational part of ourselves. Whereas loss is creativity in action, and he's puts them together into these great battles that form the stories of his work. And there's great sort of psychological insights come out of doing so.
We've spoken about how Blake was barely reviewed. He wasn't really recognised for his work in his time. He was never really financially successful from being an artist. And then we fast forward to 2019 and we've got, you know, a sellout exhibition of his work that is blasted all over all the papers. What happens between those two things?
Oh, well, it was a slow process. Certainly in the 19th century, very little happened, essentially. There was a biography, fortunately for us, a biography was written, published in 1863 by Alexander Gilchrist, and it was called The Life of William Blake, Pictor Ignotus, which was Latin for unknown artist. That is a biography of someone you've never heard of, this unknown artist. And it's a fantastic book because his friends towards the end of his life were still alive, so he's able to. That's how we get the most of our knowledge about him. A few bits of poetry would appear in Victorian anthologies, things that felt to the editor to be quite patriotic. Often he really wasn't quite grasping the context of what those words were about. But that's how things like the lines we now know as the hymn Jerusalem were sort of taken out of context, out of the preface to Blake's poem Milton, and there's a standalone piece of work. And then in World War I, music was added to it by Parry, and he gave the copyright to the women's suffrage movement, and so it had that sort of radical sort of feeling to it then. Awareness of him started to grow through this sort of time. People were looking at his work. The Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood and other artistic movements sort of really clinged to him. A bunch of the early Romantic poets would also sort of talk about him. But it was in this 1960s, really, that he sort of really hit home and sort of made sense to this new post-war generation, who very much saw themselves as individualist and wanted to sort of cast off authority and sexually liberated, but wanting a spiritual aspect to the world. And they looked at Blake and they just got everything they'd ever dreamed of. I mean, Allen Ginsberg was a major factor in this. Ginsberg had a vision himself after reading Blake's poetry that turned him into a poet and that lies at the heart of everything he did. Aldous Huxley, when he wrote The Doors of Perception, he took that phrase from Blake to talk about his experience with mescaline. And then bands like The Doors would take that from Aldous Huxley. So Blake was very much in the counterculture in the 1960s. And they tended to see the aspect of him that was about individualism and fitted with the with how they saw the world at that time. When we look at it now in the 21st century, when we've sort of moved a bit beyond individualism and we're much more see ourselves as part of a network or as part of a sea of relationships, we find there's a lot in Blake that talks on those sort of level. He says, the bird a nest, the spider a web, mankind, friendship. Man lives in his relationships. That's what life's about, essentially. There's a lot about forgiveness. And this ties into his belief in the importance of Christianity, that we have to forgive, otherwise we create our own prisons of resentment, the mind-forged manacles that sort of trap us. So every generation, as we keep looking at him through our own eyes, we're seeing more and more. And it's sort of a picture that's building and building and building. And no one thinks we've anywhere near, you know, having an overall understanding of his yet. But we know that what we've got is so useful and extraordinary and rewarding that, you know, we keep sort of digging, we keep going back to his work, and we keep understanding it afresh. And there's this weird aspect that no matter what your interests are, no matter what baggage you take to examining Blake, you always find something that's useful to you. He was so encompassing. It was like he could see the entirety of you know, the world from an outside perspective, and he missed nothing out. And I always loved the fact that the most used word in all his works, apart from, you know, there and there, is all. All is the most used word. It's so inclusive and so sort of useful. And it's taken us, you know, 200 years to get the level of understanding that we have at the moment. But, you know, it's just all signs say we should just keep going and see what else we find in there.
It's fascinating, isn't it, as you say there, to see how some of Blake's work has kind of taken on a whole life of its own, and I'm thinking primarily of Jerusalem, that it's become so divorced from its original context. What are some of the other ways that Blake's work has been misinterpreted or misunderstood, or understood in a way that really would not have been the intended?
Yeah, it's fascinating because it seems that every time the establishment, I'd use that phrase in the broader sense, goes, oh, we'll use a bit of Blake, they get him so wrong that it's beyond ironic. It's Jerusalem is the obvious example. Those words and did those feet in ancient times that we all know, and the music is so important to that, and it touches us in an important way. It is the unofficial English national anthem, but it was very much in context from the preface to his poem Milton. It was very, very angry. It was this very, very angry rant. The paragraph before starts up, rise up, O men of the new age. And he condemns what he calls the hirelings of the court, the universities. The British establishment, as he portrays them, are just wrong. They just don't get it. They just don't understand it. They parrot what they learned at university, but they have no inspiration to them. They have no sort of divine spark to them. They've lost what matters. And the whole, what is a hymn now, is a cry to sort of overthrow our idiot rulers and the stupid schools that they came from. And so when you get, you know, Eton sing Jerusalem and private schools sing Jerusalem, they're really singing about burn these places down. It's not that they've just got it slightly wrong. It's just like so wrong that it's hard to sort of that it's funny. And another example is you talked about the fantastic exhibition that the Tate did at the end of 2019, which had about 250,000 visitors and over 300 works, and it was once in a lifetime. It's a wonderful sort of thing. But to promote it, they projected his painting of a figure called Urizen onto the dome of St. Paul's Cathedral. And Urizen, he's got this beard and hair that's been blown in this gale, and he's sort of leaning out of this orb with this giant golden compass, sort of creating the world. And you might go, oh, that must be God. That looks like God. It's Satan. Urizen is Satan, as he describes it. And so to project Satan onto the dome of St. Paul's Cathedral, it's kind of funny. I mean, it's Satan as Blake defined Satan. So there's a whole other argument to go into there. There's a whole lot of interesting things. But yeah, because he sees the world so differently. When people sort of pick at things that they're drawn to, it, it, it's it's almost like there's a tricksterish element to him that, you know, to get it wrong once is fine, but when it happens every time he's sort of used, you know, it is quite funny.
I think for my final question, I'm going to pose a slight challenge to you, which is, I wonder if you could nominate three of Blake's works that personally are your favourites that you would urge everyone to seek out if they're able to.
I would first say The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, which was a small book he wrote in the 1790s, really because he was arguing with a Swedish mystic called Swedenborg. He's trying to explain why Swedenborg was wrong. But by doing so, he basically set out how he sees the world in as short and as punchy sort of way as possible. It has this great section called The Proverbs of Hell. He thought Swedenborg was too enamoured of the angels. He needed to understand that the demons as well. So he put all the proverbs that he heard from hell in this great section. And it's not long, and it's dense. But it's such an important clue to his worldview that I would definitely recommend The Marriage of Heaven and Hell to sort of anyone. I think The Painting of Newton, again, because it unlocks so much of how he saw the world. People may know this painting of Newton. He's sort of like he's this naked figure, like a Greek god with blonde hair. And he sort of appears to be under the ocean, or in a cave or something. It's this really strange, organic sort of world that he's in. But if you look, he's not wet, his hair's not wet. He's focused down on this scroll, this piece of paper, with a compass, because he represents this character, Urizen. And all he can see is this circle that he's drawing. He has no concept of the rich, organic sort of world all around him. He's only can see this sort of rational mental construction that he's sort of making. And it's such a key idea in Blake's thinking. It's sort of, you can think about his painting of Newton for a long time, believe me. There's a lot going on there. Yeah, a whole bunch of things are flashing in front of my mind. There is one painting of two angels above the lying body of Christ, and their wings just sweep up, and they just sort of touch each other's wings, and there's this elegant symmetry to it, and it's just a glimpse of another world. In the 18th century, English artists did not come up with images like that. It's so from nowhere, you know. It's just a beautiful piece of design, but the atmosphere to it is wonderful. It's really wonderful. Yeah, I think those three, and if I could have another 100 as well, that would be nice.
That was John Higgs. His book, William Blake Versus the World, is available now, published by Orion. You can find a link in the show notes. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. We'll be back on Friday when Leah Garrett will be speaking about the secret Jewish commandos who helped defeat the Nazis.